Hello and welcome to Getting Goosebumps, the weekly podcast exploring the business of storytelling, where I interview many of the world's greatest marketers and storytellers to share their insights and ideas of how to put emotion into marketing. This week I have the absolute pleasure to talk to the CEO of Copyblogger, Brian Clark. Brian is probably best known for content marketing years before the phrase was coined, and building the largest and most followed and revered marketing blog on the planet. This week, we debate who are the best storytellers in the world. We look at how to reverse engineer your audience for the purpose of research, and we look at the value of building your audience long before you think about monetizing. So, hi everyone, welcome to another show of the podcast. I'm really excited today. I'm joined by the CEO of Copyblogger, Brian Clark. Hello, Brian.
How are you?
I'm really, really good. How are you doing over there?
Pretty good, pretty good. Summer is kind of winding down. Kids are about to go back to school, which means we start going full speed again. We kind of follow the kid school semester approach, where we work really hard in the fall, really hard in the spring, and take breaks at over the holidays at Christmas, and then go a little bit slower in the summer. But this summer has not slowed down at all, so it's a good thing, though, not a bad thing.
Yeah, I guess so. So is that more like a work-life balance, or is it a sort of trend of your audience? Or
it's interesting. It's just the kind of work rhythm, I think, that we started with, because we're all parents. So, you know, when the kids are off, we try to make sure that we worked hard enough on the last sprint, you know, to at least take a little bit of time. But I don't know that it balances out all that much. You might have to ask my kids.
Well, you've got to aim for it though, right? Brian, just for the very few who may not know about Copyblogger, could you start by just telling us how you got to be where you are now, for anyone that doesn't know, and exactly what Copyblogger is and does.
Right. So maybe I should start backwards. Copyblogger was started in January 2006 as a one-person blog by me, talking about the marketing strategies that I had used to build three previous businesses, mainly in the professional services industry. And it was really about using content to build an audience and then, of course, eventually do business. And that became known as content marketing a few years later. Even though I'd been doing it since 1999, I never called it that. But that's what we ended up with. And so Copyblogger now has been going almost 10 years, which is amazing. But starting as a blog, we never took venture capital. We don't do advertising, at least historically. And we were able to get to over $10 million in revenue last year. So we're kind of an example that content marketing, that building an audience first, is a way to build a business.
Well, absolutely. So you were doing content marketing before content marketing, you know, before it had a label and before it had a name.
Yeah, and Joe Paluzzi over at Content Marketing Institute finally convinced me, after talking about content marketing for a couple of years, that was the term we should all adopt. And it's now a $44 billion industry. It's huge. So it's a real thing. But when I started out in the late 90s, I just wanted to be able to find a way to make a living writing. I was a frustrated attorney. I left the practice of law. I don't know if you know this. It's not a very well hidden secret that all attorneys think that they can become writers. So, and I, through the process, my first business kind of just crashed and burned. I didn't know what I was doing, but I kind of figured things out. And again, that's what became using content to build related businesses, that I was more of an entrepreneur who could write than a traditional writer. I'm very have a nasty independent streak. So even the thought of becoming a writer and having to deal with New York publishers or LA, you know, screenwriting or producers or whatever the case may be, I didn't like that at all. So I looked at the internet and said, hey, I don't have to ask anyone's permission. I can go do that.
Yeah. And I guess back then it was different to it is now. Would you agree it's more competitive now? And I'm sat here wondering, as I'm listening to you speak, what advantages has that afforded you starting all of those years ago? And do the same principles still apply?
Yeah, I think the same principles apply. As far as it's a two-sided coin in that now, of course, more people do this type of marketing because it's what works. It's a uniquely kind of internet thing. The internet, as opposed to television, radio, or whatever the previous broadcast mediums were, puts them in control. They don't have to sit there and watch your ad, you know. They don't have to put up with their content being interrupted. They can search. They follow recommendations on social. They're self-empowered. So you have to give them something they want as opposed to something they want to avoid. So people, when they are ready to make a purchase or are considering it, they go out there and start doing their own research. And the gist and the beauty of content marketing is if you can show up, not with a pitch, but with a helpful amount of information that kind of leads to the sale, then more often than not, you end up getting the sale. So the difference being that there was no blogs, no conferences, no courses, no university training in the 90s how to do this. We literally just made it up as we went along. You watch what other people do. You try it yourself. It works. It doesn't work. That kind of thing. And now there's just so many resources. So it may become more competitive, but with the mainstreaming of social media and the information that's available to get started, I think it's easier now than before. And I know that some people might disagree with it, but it really is, because everyone is in a position to provide distribution for your content if you create something good. And let's face it, you're not going to get away with not creating something good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I do think that's controversial, though. I mean, I agree with you that it's easier, certainly in principle. I think the amount of competition now, people start from scratch. People are literally overwhelmed by the amount of content coming towards people, and you know the size of the marketplaces and competition. You know, it is reaching saturation point wherever you look now. So, if you were to start Copyblogger again from scratch today, what would your expectations be in terms of timelines compared to how long it took you to build it in the first place?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I probably wouldn't start Copyblogger today. I mean, Copyblogger's time really, I mean, why it was the right thing to do in 2006 was because that's where we were at the conversation. We were pre-industry, and then we kind of flowed with it, right? You know, we helped bring a lot of people along. I mean, it's technically still the world's largest content marketing blog. So, yeah, I don't think I would jump on a bandwagon that had left the station a while ago. What you do is always look for, you know, where are the opportunities now? What needs are not being served? Or how can I, in my own unique way, my own voice, my own personality, serve an audience or a tribe or however you want to characterize it? So to give you an example, I launched a new podcast called Unemployable, which is kind of a cheeky reference to entrepreneurs, freelancers, people who don't want a job.
Yeah, brilliant.
So that is what I would do right now. And it's really interesting because in 2005, the year podcasting started, my first idea was to start a podcast, not Copyblogger. Now, how dumb would that have been? You see? So there's always a time in a right audience in a right position for the next project. So I think that's how we have to think in terms of if you're starting something completely new, then you have complete freedom. if you have an existing business, then you have to look around at what your competitors are doing or not doing. And still, a lot of people are just not doing anything, or they're just not doing it well. So that's why I say I still think there's just tons of opportunity to step up and do something different that resonates with an audience.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And, you know, when you say look at your competition and see what they're doing, if you do that, it doesn't necessarily mean that you copy it. And in a lot of...
No, the opposite. You don't exactly. Copy it.
Absolutely.
I mean, you may see some things they're doing well, and they're kind of fundamental things, and that would be part of any plan. But the key is to be different. There's an author and a friend of ours over here named Sally Hogshead, who says different is better than better. And that sounds simplistic, but ultimately when it comes down to it, being uniquely you is something no one else can copy. Except, but everyone's afraid to do that, right? That's the struggle.
Do you think bravery is a big part of it? And, you know, I want to get your thoughts on authenticity in a little while. But to be truly authentic, you need to have an element of bravery, right?
Yeah, it absolutely. And I think people tend to look at those of us who manage to, authenticity is a loaded word. I mean, it's not necessarily just whatever you want to say. It's what aspect of you best resonates with an audience. So that's one thing I want to make clear. But as far as courage, people look at those of us who have audiences and show up every day in some form of media presence and think that we're fearless. No, we're scared every day. You know, every time we try to do something new, it's a leap. You know, you never know necessarily how something is going to be responded to. So there's always that element. And, you know, I just always stress to people that courage doesn't mean that you're not afraid. It means you go ahead and do it anyway.
Absolutely. And I guess the day you haven't got that sense of fear is the day you need to make sure you're not being complacent, or you really do need to check the strategy and make sure that you're being as brave as you need to be, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's just the courage to be yourself to some degree, but also your best self, the self that your audience needs. And when we talk about finding our voice, that's the balance that we're looking for between what makes us feel comfortable with what we share with people and what they're getting out of it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that you've given your audience in absolute spades, you know, right from the word go, really. And that's probably why your audience and community's grown so large. Tell me a little bit about when you decided to monetize that community, and how did that work out, and what are the steps, and what advice can you give to the audience?
Yeah, so the previous three bit successful businesses, I should say, I had started four, were applying innovative online marketing approaches to plain old offline businesses. Like I had a solo law practice was really the first way I independently supported myself, because I was running out of money with the other business. And then I started two real estate brokerages, which is a traditional business as you can get, except that they were completely virtual. They were websites and powered by, online presence only, as opposed to the brick and mortar shop and all the offline ads and all that kind of thing. So they weren't innovative industries. They were innovative approaches to building a business within a business, you know, an industry you know people need and want and are pretty lucrative. So when I started Copyblogger, I didn't have a business model. I didn't have a product. I didn't have a service. I just knew that if I built an audience and served their problems and desires from an information standpoint, that I would start figuring out, okay, where's the pain points? What do they want? What are they frustrated by? And can I create something that will satisfy that problem? And there you go. You're in business. That's business 101. But I went a year and a half, really, finding other ways to support myself and not monetizing Copyblogger, really, except for a few tests to see what people would buy. And then we kind of figured it out, and then we created our first product in the fall of 2007, which was an online training course. And that was a hit, and we went from zero to six figures in a week and then seven figures by the end of that year. Yeah, and then in 2008. So that was a collaboration with a partner. This was very big for me, that I wanted to do what I was good at, which was content, marketing, strategy, building audiences, right? And then finding congruency between what it is that that I'm having common with them and what they want to buy. And then I would partner with other people who could fulfill that. So the first business, that was kind of out of just necessity. I couldn't do it all myself. In 2008, I got into the WordPress design and software market, and I'm not a coder at all. So again, I saw the opportunity and partnered with someone who could do the code, and that was another seven-figure business. Then another one came along. So I kept launching all these separate companies off of the blog thanks to the audience, and they were all home runs. But eventually we got to 2010, and we had ambition to build something even bigger, which required that all these smart people that I'd partnered with, they had no incentive to talk to one another. So we merged all the companies together into Copyblogger Media. And so for the last 5 years, we've been operating as that larger ongoing concern. To effectively, our idea in 2010 was to build what is now known as the Rainmaker platform. It's kind of an all-in-one online marketing solution.
Wow. I mean, right there, if anybody's ever wondering what the ROI, the value, and the power of content marketing, I think that short story definitely illustrates that. But there's two things there that I want to pick up on, Brian, which I thought were really good. First of all, what a great word, congruency between the community you've built and you giving them an offer, you know, that's, you know, really aligned. It's something that they generally want. And it strikes me that you did the hard part first of growing the audience. And am I right in saying it's almost quite easy then to find something that they want, because you've built the audience, you know them really well. Because most businesses say, right, we're in business, we're selling these things, these widgets. Now we need to go and find an audience and build an audience so we can sell these things to them. You built an audience first with absolute no ROI in mind, per se, and then mapped it afterwards. Would you say that still stands? You know, that's definitely the most powerful way to monetize content marketing, audience first?
Well, if you're, like you pointed out, if you're a startup or a new company, absolutely. And that's gaining a lot of steam. It's almost become an aspect of the whole lean startup thing, which we've always followed agile development and lean processes, even before I knew what those words meant. But yeah, so there was a case study done on us in the book, The Lean Entrepreneur, and it was the audience first approach. Mm-hmm. Now we've got a book coming out called Content Inc. in a month or so. Same thing. All these examples of companies that started without money, really, and without, you know, what we typically think of the startup thing in the last few years is you go out with an idea and you get money and, you know, and this is a completely different approach. But it's so much more effective because you're dealing with a real group of people, not an abstract market, not some crazy idea you have in your head about what people might want. Instead, you're figuring out ways to see what people actually want. And it ranges because I've been able to do a lot of that through two things: observation, just very carefully watching the frustration or the desire that's expressed by people, coupled with the fact that I am very similar to our target audience. I'm a content creator. I wanted to be a writer. I'm not a coder. I'm not a technician. You know what I'm saying? So there's some congruency between me and the audience that helps with product development. But other ways, you could go into complete different markets that you have no idea about. And there are ways such as making offers to your audience for affiliate products. You may not gain that customer, but you're not really doing it just for the commission. You're doing it to see if someone will actually take out their wallet and pay for that thing.
Yeah.
That's valuable information. If you have an audience and you're scraping by on advertising monetization, but you notice that one particular vendor always comes back to you to advertise, you know that that thing is selling or they wouldn't be coming back.
Yep, absolutely.
That's real intelligence. That's concrete evidence of things that people want to buy. And yet, as you mentioned, the typical way to do it is completely backwards. And no wonder so many businesses fail.
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess, Brian, there's lots of people listening to this saying, you know, they also agree, but we have an existing business. We have to change our marketing plan because obviously we need to get digital and embrace content and all the rest of it. So what about the businesses that haven't got the luxury of building the audience first because they're in a business and they're looking for new effective ways to market their products and services? What's the quickest way of building an audience that then has the congruency between what they're interested in and what you're selling?
Yeah, so in my mind, that's easier because you're starting with something, whether it be design services or real estate brokerage or whatever the case may be, that you know people want. There's people buying these type of things every day. So you've got that part. Now you have to work backwards. Okay, who's the type of person who is going to buy what I'm selling? And then work your way back through the journey that they need to take. Where do they start and what steps do they go through in choosing who to work with? And then that's a way to develop a content strategy and content assets that attract those people to you, hopefully get them on an email list because you're not just trying to take one shot at converting someone into a customer or a client. It usually takes a while and it's much more effective that way. And by the way, email remains by far the dominant sales channel online. So it's really, you know, people want what you want, but how do they make a decision? What information do they need to make a choice? And how can you present it to them in a way that makes them know, like, and trust you to where you're the obvious choice by the time they're ready to pull the trigger?
Yeah, absolutely. And I reckon, you know, that just could be the $6 million question there. And, you know, something I'm very passionate about and keen to talk to you about, Brian, is the power of storytelling and connecting with an audience. What are some of the more emotive elements of content that you've put out there that you've seen gain lots of traction and engagement? And, you know, what have you gleaned from those elements of content that you could share with our audience?
Yeah, so I think it's more fair to say that content addresses the emotions of the prospect more than the content is emotive, although I've seen people make that mistake before. Just remember, the prospect is the hero of their own story. Now, if you want to show up and participate in that story, then you have to take the role of the helpful guide, the useful mentor, if you will, to where, you know, I'm going to provide you with information that makes it feel like I'm inside your head. Like, I know exactly what you're feeling. This is empathy, of course. This is the big daddy.
Like the narrator or the reflection character if we were in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. So you show up and you just methodically, piece by piece, seem to give them exactly what they need. But that's because you've done your research. You've done your homework. You know who your target customer is. You know why they go on the journey in the first place. So it with story is such an incredibly powerful thing, whether it be from a copywriting standpoint, a marketing standpoint. But you're always telling a story over time. You just have to realize that they're the center of the story, not you. And if you can again, there's that word congruence between how they emotionally feel about the decision-making process or the selection process that they're going on. Again, there is nothing that I found that is more effective than content that arrives at the right time. And the amazing thing is, if you set it up correctly, it kind of operates on its own. It's very different from the form of cold call or somehow reaching out to someone, interrupting them, and getting them into a sales cycle. With content, they're in the sales cycle before they ever feel like there's any sort of selling going on. That's what you want. People don't want to be, they don't want to be sold to. They want to make a decision. But if you are there that influence that decision in a very helpful way, it's pretty amazing.
Do you think a lot of content marketers fall into the trap of making themselves the hero? And, you know, is that the biggest contributing factor to why a lot of content doesn't get traction and doesn't get shared?
Absolutely. And I've been preaching this for 10 years. I mean, look, we all have egos, but if you can't let your ego take a back seat, you know, I always say in this story, you're a hero. You're not the hero. Mm-hmm. And it's a very subtle thing. So you still get to shine. You still get to be an important person in this person's life. But yeah, a lot of the people, this goes back to something you mentioned earlier about the hard part being to build the audience first. People do build audiences and they never take the leap over to the product or service thing because they were building an audience around themselves. And some people have that kind of personality. But that doesn't mean those people want to do business with you. And it's sad more than it's funny. But I think there's a lot of narcissism that has come along with online, audience building and social media in particular.
Yeah.
And those are the people, some people you look at and say, oh, that's the big star, and they're poor. So.
Brilliant. Tell it like it is. I love it. I was going to ask you, actually, what's the biggest marketing faux pas that gets on your nerves?
I think we just talked about it.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Yeah, I mean, it just amazes me, this me, 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 us messaging. It's just so ineffective and so egocentric. And then people, and these are the type of people who are like, well, content doesn't work or social media doesn't work. Well, right, you're coming into a cocktail party like a jerk, trying to close business, trying to propose marriage on the first date, instead of being social and helpful. It's not that much different than offline. And yet people get online and lose their minds because they're like, oh, I could talk to anyone and I'm going to be rich. It doesn't work that people are still people.
Super. People go online and lose their minds. That's got to be the quote of the show so far. I love that. What's the best way to sanity check your own content to make sure that you're not doing it wrong to that extent? What would you say?
Yeah, there's an old saying in literary circles that for writers, you have to kill your darlings, because the thing you find so clever and interesting from your perspective may be completely off the mark. And if you're starting with your perspective instead of theirs, again, going back to empathy, put yourself in their shoes, then walk the path in their shoes. Mm. And that's very hard for some people to do because you have to be very disciplined and you never take your eye off of what you're doing here. You're serving other people. Uh-huh. If you don't have that discipline, you tend to get off track and that's when you make a mistake and you waste time and money. Now, we all make mistakes and you can always adapt and tweak and recover from that. But I've seen some people, they just go so far down the path in their own shoes and not the people they're trying to talk to.
Yeah, it really is so true. I mean, we go through a process. We do persona mapping, but we also do a separate additional exercise, which we call, I'm sure you do something similar with a different name maybe, or I don't know, empathy mapping. So
exactly. I love empathy mapping.
Yeah,
that's exactly the process that we go through and that we recommend. For that, there's two parts. what's it like to be in their shoes, to see the world, and that's empathy mapping. Uh-huh. And then you can use something else. You may use customer experience mapping to walk the path, right? So, yeah. Absolutely. No, I love that. Great.
Yeah, so, you know, these are the sort of very unsexy things, you know, the research-led aspects that, you know, it's like homework. It's hard work. It's not easy, this stuff, is it? But these are the groundwork things that you need to get through in order to make your content really shine or have a shot at creating any sort of congruency at all, right?
I think so. And going back for decades, even 100 years, the great copywriters, the great advertising people, it all begins with research. And so often you would have these great advertising men, and they were all men back then, who would go into a client and see their business with an outside perspective. So that's the other side of the coin, that when we're in our own businesses, we can't find the story right under our nose. We dismiss it. We take it for granted. And sometimes an outsider can come in and say, why aren't we telling this story? This is going to work. This is what people want to hear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Do you know, I still haven't been into an organization, small and large, who has done empathy mapping before. And it never ceases to amaze me. You know, we work with some large organizations, and it's literally light bulb moments, you know, pennies drop.
Because it's so useful, right? If you really sit there in that room and commit to leaving your preconceptions behind. That's the hard part, especially the executives, right? Because the executives are very smart people. Let's not, you know, I hate when new marketers come in and try to say everyone's dumb and, you know, no, you don't get anywhere in the world with being dumb. But when things shift and you're kind of trapped by your own success, that's where a process like empathy mapping, get them in the room and they'll come out going, oh my goodness, I was completely off the mark. But now that we're on the mark, we're going to make lots and lots of money. That should motivate any executive to go ahead and change their mind.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we do it, our job is to ask great questions. But, of course, then we get great answers. And you're absolutely right. The great answers are in them. It's just a case of pulling them out.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to Joe Polizzi about this, the very same thing. I asked Joe, who are the best storytellers in the world? Now, I'm going to tell you what he said because I don't want you to say the same thing. So it's going to be a bit tougher for you, Brian. we had a great conversation about Hollywood. But I'm interested because I talked to some content marketers who will tell you content marketers are the best storytellers in the world. No, I'm not so sure about that.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. I think if I can tell where you're going, I think that we can aspire to be great storytellers by reflecting on those who are the true great storytellers. But I don't want to steal your thunder. Tell me what Joe said.
Well, no, I'm not going to tell you what Joe said.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to tell me so I wouldn't say the same thing.
No. He alluded, we had a great conversation about Hollywood. But I don't want to dive into that because you've got to listen to it if you want to know what he said. And it was a really great conversation with Joe. I really enjoyed it. But he agreed with you. I agree with you. Content marketers aren't the best storytellers. So where else can we get inspiration from? Who are the best storytellers in the 21st century now?
I think the best storytellers are the ones that have been the best storytellers in any other century, and regardless of medium. Now, we could look at Hollywood. And so earlier I mentioned that I didn't want to deal with New York and I didn't want to go be a cog in the machine in Hollywood, but I did study screenwriting pretty intensely before I decided to go the internet way. And then once I read a book called Permission Marketing by Seth Godin in 99, which was my first marketing book between you and I. but then I understood that the internet is a new form of direct marketing, not the kind where you buy a mailing list and send junk mail, one where you connect with people directly by email, you know, build an audience, right? So that was a light bulb moment for me because I had been doing that well. The part I didn't understand was then you have to sell something. So at that point is when I became a just a diehard student of direct response copywriting, you know, the stuff that gets people to take action, that connects, that promotes engagement. And really, when you look forward 5 or 6 years, that's what Copyblogger was about, right?
Well,
you know, studying screenwriting and then studying copywriting, I saw the congruency, again, that word. Like, this is the same thing. This is about inspiring people one way or another. And we talked about customer experience mapping, and you'll hear, you probably use the terminology buyer's journey as well.
Yep.
So we've been mapping that to Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, and it works perfectly. And guess what the key ingredients of that are? The prospect is the hero, and you're the mentor. That's exactly what, at its simplest, that's it. If you can do that alone, your marketing will improve. It gets, you can go down the rabbit hole many, many layers. But that narrative that we have responded to since the beginning of civilization, it's story, you know? Mm-hmm. What story are you going to tell? How are you going to enter the prospect story? Because trust me, the story is about them in their mind. And if you don't recognize that, they'll ignore you.
Once you've done your homework, you've done the hard work, you've empathy mapped your audience, and you put your audience in the center of the story, so they're the hero. On a sort of more tactical level now, because Brian, you know, you're not one of the biggest content marketing blogs in the world for just by pure luck. You're phenomenal at crafting great language, and setting the scene and illustrating your points. What are some practical, tactical tips you could give to aspiring writers and content marketers that just want to make their content better?
Yeah, so again, we cannot gloss over the research phase. During that research phase, here's something that I always see some confusion and even pushback about looking at search engine research or keyword research, which has become more sophisticated as Google's become more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you'll get purist writers or, you know, other creative, well-meaning people who are like, I'm not interested in spamming the search engines. That I don't care about keywords. I'm creating content for people, right? Mm-hmm. And I've been preaching that since day one. But guess who uses search engines? People. The language they use is what they type into that little box in Google. Yes. And being able to know that is like looking inside their head. That's how they're thinking when they're thinking about a problem or desire that they have. So one of the great old direct response copywriters was a guy named Eugene Schwartz, and he would spend a big chunk of his day just reading, you know, the magazines or other media that the audience he was currently trying to reach would like and would read themselves. It could be a trashy tabloid, you know, depending on the audience he was trying to reach.
Yeah.
But he said, you know, there's your audience. There's the language they use, right? So what better than keyword research? Because Schwartz would have loved it. He'd be like, wow, this is so easy compared to what I had to go through.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet we have well-meaning writers saying, I'm not interested in that. Don't think about – because, again, I don't think about SEO. But when you reflect that language back to them, the language they actually use, that's what Google's looking for. So people respond well to it. You get links and social signals and all that kind of crazy stuff that Google algorithm actually looks at. So to a large degree, besides the technical aspects of a great site and other stuff related to SEO, a lot of it really is about just serving people. But you can't use your language because you prefer it over the language that they prefer. And again, we're just touching on the same thing. It's them, not you, even when it comes down to language.
Absolutely. But, you know, a lot of people out there use keyword research and then probably disrupt their content to make sure it's got these words in there. But actually, you're saying that, you know, you'll value keyword research primarily just to understand the language that your audience are using in the first place, which I think, you know, I'm seeing a bit of a pattern here, Brian. You seem to sort of reverse engineer things or do things completely the other way around to the vast majority of people out there. And, you know, it's kind of working for you as well, isn't it?
Well, because you have to reverse engineer people, and people are complicated, and it takes work, and you have to be, committed to trying to understand this person almost better than they understand themselves.
Well, so will your philosophy and your approach get easier as voice search impacts Google and search engines and that kind of thing? What do you think will be the biggest sort of impacting factor there?
Well, one thing I want to stress again is that once you start serving an audience, they give you what you need, that whether a particular piece of content resonated with them or flopped is the easiest way to think about, iterative or agile content development. Pay attention. Don't have a plan. Okay, we're going to do this piece of content and you got 52 weeks mapped out. Don't do that. Yeah, because you're going to learn something, I swear, between, in the first month that might throw your plan out the window. And that's the other mistake I think people make, is they're too committed to their initial plan. And despite real-time evidence to the contrary, they stick with it. You know, when you serve an audience, they tell you a lot of amazing, valuable things. But at essence, first and foremost, they tell you what they like and what they don't like. And the great thing about, the mainstreaming of social media, everyone's on Facebook. It's now an advertising platform, but you can run tests with small amounts of money with your content. Advertise your content, not your products and services. And again, and that's another thing that that people, if they're going to spend a dollar, I want that ROI immediately. And yet the most grizzled, hardcore pay-per-click veterans out there know that you don't, in most cases, you do not sell the product or service. You entice them onto an email list with great content, and then conversion rates go up significantly when they go through that type of content-driven process as opposed to a straight pitch. So it's not a touchy-feely thing, people. It's what works better.
Brilliant. Brian, give us all a little bit of hope here. When's the last time you did something that completely bombed?
All the time, really. Yeah. I mean, I've started a couple of new projects in the last, 8 months that are in different content topical areas, I should say. So to me, that is nothing but an exercise in discovery and figuring out what people work.
Yeah.
So I don't feel bad when something doesn't work. I make a notation that, that didn't respond for whatever reasons. And sometimes it's hard to pinpoint. You know, you could have a great piece of content and the headline was just wrong. You know, it happens. Headlines are critical to getting someone to make that split second decision to invest some time with you or not. And on the other hand of that, because of the BuzzFeed feeds of the world, you also have to make sure that you don't go overboard on your headline for your particular audience, and you'll only know what's appropriate by knowing who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is a case of going back again to understanding your audience. But it's an interesting perspective, isn't it? You know, it's not failure, it's just insight.
Exactly. There, every failure, if it doesn't teach you something, then you're not paying attention, because every failure has a lesson in it, but especially in content marketing. Because you'll, in your head, you have to make, you know your audience, and then you're making educated guesses, which people who don't do research are not making educated guesses. They're just guessing, right? So you start with an educated guess. Let's say you could go this way or that way on a particular thing. You try one, that turns out not to be the way. You try the other, it's the right way. Now you know.
Simple. So So if you wrote a piece of content you really believed in, you thought this is good stuff, this is really valuable to my audience, and then it didn't get the traction you were expecting, do you still go through the exercise of looking at that, maybe rewriting and testing a different headline and relaunching it?
That's an interesting question, and again, it's so tempting to get attached, but yet. This is a very Zen practice. You have to not be attached to outcomes and deal with reality. But when the first 3 months of Copyblogger, I was a complete unknown. It was just like everyone else's first 3 months, crickets chirping loudly. I tried a couple of things that, again, to use your language, I think that were meaningful and important to me that I thought would work, and they didn't. And then the third thing I tried did, and that was really the catalyst that got Copyblogger noticed. So you can't – I'm not saying that something can't be reworked, or maybe it was just the headline or the execution or something. I'm not saying that, but I am saying – don't get attached to the thing that didn't work, no matter how much you loved it. You can hear what I'm about to say again. It doesn't matter. It's only what they love.
There's some big messages coming out of this, Brian. I'm certainly getting a lot from this. I've asked a number of people in a number of interviews the following question, and I'm having some fun hearing different answers. So I'm going to ask you the same question. I've heard for a while people say content is king. Then I've heard people say context is king. What's the next king, Brian? Or is this just all a load of rubbish?
All this is king, is dead. This stuff cycles through every year, which if you're in the game long enough, you notice that. But content, context, yes, very important C words, but I will give you the most important one, and that's customer. Again, start with them and then deliver the right content in the right context, and you've got the total package. You can't operate without any of those, but I would say the person you're trying to reach is more important than the mechanism or the channel, right? So, again, start with them in mind first and back your way out of it.
Do you know, I've heard some really good answers to that question. That is tough to – that's tough to argue with.
Well, good.
That really is tough to argue with. Good answer. My final question for you, Brian, is just around – authenticity. And I really do believe from a storytelling point of view that if you go into most organizations, there's lots of great stories that are just waiting to be told. They're just not in the marketing department. And I actually think stories that start in the marketing department, you know, aren't as authentic as they could be. In fact, maybe I'd go as far to say that it could be synthetic stories. What would your advice be in terms of looking inside an organization to find existing great stories? You know, is that something that you believe in and think is worthwhile? How would you go about that?
I think I agree with you 100%. And as you're seeing more of this movement of, you know, employees becoming your ambassadors for storytelling and being allowed to speak in social channels on behalf of the company, which, you know, companies are usually always shutting people down. But let me tell you one of my favorite stories that I think proves your point. So it's at least, I think it was 100 years ago, a guy named Claude Hopkins, he wrote a book called, well, forget it. It doesn't matter. I'm mixing up two books here, so I'm going to ignore that part. Anyway, he was hired by Schlitz Beer to help them out with their marketing. They were in fifth place in the market. So Claude goes to the brewing facility, you know, way outside the marketing department, and he's taking a tour of the brewery. Mm-hmm. And he notices the water filtration systems they have for, they were pumping water out of the Great Lakes, purifying it and using that for their beer. And, you know, and so Claude is interested by this. And he said, you know, why haven't you told this story about the water? And they look at him like he's crazy. And they're like, every beer company does this. This is nothing. He said, no, no one's told this story yet. They do it. They go to number one in the market.
Really?
And yeah. So again, that was the story I was thinking of earlier when I said an outside perspective can sometimes do wonders.
Yeah.
But talk about, you know, a process that every beer company uses, and yet he latched onto that. Now, would that work today? I mean, you know, Coors actually uses that. That's been their marketing the entire time here in Colorado, and it's not the best beer, but it works for them.
That's brilliant. It really does illustrate the point because, you know, something that's taken for granted, you know, you can't see the wood for the trees in your own organization. The stories everywhere, and I really do believe that, and you know, the best ones are not in the marketing department. You know, I'm a very, very big advocate of that.
Yeah, it's just having the patience and the willingness to find them and go back to empathy mapping. That's the kind of stuff that comes out in those sessions, and they often leave people just amazed at what was right under their noses once they focused on the people they're trying to reach instead of, we want to sell more widgets and make more money.
Brilliant. Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Before we end the show, I want to give the final words to you. I want you to tell us and remind us where people can find out more about you. Is there anything you would like to draw our audience's attention to or leave us with?
Well, of course, copyblogger.com for almost a decade now has been producing just loads of free content, and we've worked over the years to organize that as best we can. We're always doing that. We're about to do another redesign of the site to make it even more useful. But we do have an entire library of ebooks that talk about the fundamentals of content marketing. So content marketing strategy, email, SEO, landing pages, all that kind of stuff. And it's completely free. So if you go to copyblogger.com and scroll down to the middle of the homepage, you'll see Copyblogger ebooks, and you can sign up for those. And that's a great education if you want some clarity on how kind of all of this stuff works together. Of course, Copyblogger publishes every week. For you audio people, we now have a podcast network, which was a big step we took earlier this year, and that is at rainmaker.fm. And finally, for all of you proudly independent of a job people out there, in whatever capacity, you can listen to my new podcast, Unemployable, which is at unemployable.com.
Fantastic. I'm definitely going to be a regular listener of that. And you mentioned a book as well, Brian. Is this in conjunction with the Content Marketing Institute, is it?
Oh, right, right. Yeah. So Joe, who we were talking about earlier, has written probably the book I should have written, but he let me write the foreword. So we have a running joke that I teach people how to write, and I'm the only person in the industry who hasn't written a book because I find it, for our business model at least, much better to just put it out there than necessarily to sell books. But Joe is an excellent author, and he did a case study on us, along with, I think, you know, 20 other companies that started audience first and then built those into successful businesses. So Content Marketing Institute has historically focused on the enterprise crowd, you know, where the big dollars are. Mm-hmm. But Joe used these very principles to start that very company and the largest content marketing conference in the world. So I think it's something that's very close to his heart personally. Mm-hmm. But once he started digging into the stories, it's just kind of amazing how effective this audience first approach is.
Fantastic. Can't wait for that book to come out.
That's called Content Inc., by the way.
Yeah, fantastic. I think that's out in September.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. Well, once again, Brian, thanks for being a most entertaining and educating guest on the show. Hopefully we might get you back at some point in the future, because there's lots more stuff I'd love to talk to you about. So if that's a possibility, you'd certainly be welcome back anytime.
Absolutely, and I've enjoyed this, and thank you for laughing at all my bad jokes.
An absolute pleasure. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Bye-bye.
So that's it for another week. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. If you did, please feel free to subscribe or even check out our Getting Goosebumps marketing book available in Amazon. If you have any specific questions, you can also tweet us using the hashtag AskPH. I'd be delighted to answer your questions. Until next week, goodbye.